What is this thing?
Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's Community News Program, Off the Hour. Today is Friday, December 10th. My name is Brian Jefferson, and I will be your host today. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Kanyenkehaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Stay tuned, we'll be right back.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
First, some news. SAQ workers are on strike. They rejected the agreement in principle that their union reached last week. They say they want competitive wages and fewer overtime hours. Earlier walkouts since mid-November left some SAQ store shelves empty throughout the province. They're not the only sector that has been striking. The union representing Quebec's public daycare workers has reached a tentative agreement with the provincial government this week. This agreement prevents a walkout. 11,000 workers shut down 400 public provincial daycares last week. Daycare workers are part of the CSN union. And the Quebec School Board reassigned a teacher for violating provincial law by wearing a hijab in class. Fatima Anvaris taught grade 3 at an English elementary school in Chelsea, Quebec. Bill 21 prohibits some civil servants, like teachers, from wearing religious symbols at work. This includes the hijab. The English Montreal School Board wanted all English school boards to be exempt from Bill 21, but the province's highest court reaffirmed that this regulation applies to everyone. And the number of coronavirus cases keeps rising across Quebec. The province reported 2,013 new cases today, an unprecedented high since the spring wave of COVID-19. This rise comes as the pandemic restrictions ease. Starting December 23rd, the Quebec government will legally allow private gatherings of up to 20 people. And the federal report published this week officially validates the mistreatment of temporary foreign workers on farms across Canada during the pandemic. Auditor General Karen Hogan says inspectors often failed to check whether farms provided drinking water, disinfected, separate accommodations for sick workers, or spaces for new arrivals to quarantine. Farms were hotbeds for COVID-19 outbreaks at the start of the pandemic, and many continue to be. This is Off the Hour on 90.3 FM.
CKUT
Radio.
Radio.
Sound
waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
I'm Martin Carly, and I like to popularize science. Vaccination against COVID-19 for children aged 5 to 11 has begun. As parents, you may be asking if your child will receive the same vaccine as adults. The vaccine used for children younger than 12 years old contains a smaller amount of mRNA because children's immune systems respond better than those of adults. And even though they're given smaller doses, the vaccine is just as effective.
For more information, visit quebec.ca/youthvaccine. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome back to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. The time is just after 5 p.m. My name is Brian Jefferson. We're sharing the air this season with creators that you might like to hear from and will continue to do that today.
We're about to tune into a December 5th, 2021 episode of Dissident Island Radio. We'll be back at the top of the hour.
Where's the volume button?
I'm sitting on the heater.
We'll probably start from just a very general...
Blah, 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 blah.
Who are you?
Blah, blah, blah.
What do you do?
Blah, blah, blah.
How does it work? Kind of thing.
It's very cold.
Some nice little things there.
1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2.
Let's all be friends.
And we're going to do an interview now.
Hello and welcome to Dissident Island Radio. Episode 258 is December 3rd, 2021, last show of the year. And we've managed to survive and we're back in the studio still, Omicron notwithstanding. So on tonight's show, we are going to have a DJ in the studio, which is another great leap forward out of the abyss. Our DJ for this evening is Chasm, and I believe he's going to be playing some drum and bass. He might even have a live MC in the studio, which is an extra treat. Legal Andy, ACAB Andy, is in the studio. As always, he's going to be talking to us about the progress of the Police Crime and Sentencing Bill and a few other updates and obituaries from the legal support world. We're going to hear from Channel Rescue following the deaths of 27 people in the channel. Last week, I caught up with Channel Rescue and they're going to tell us about their campaign, the challenges they're making to the government's policy. But first...
Originally, the intention was to have a chat on the practicalities of prisoner solidarity. So the ins and outs and everything may be a bit cliche given it's the end of the year and the holiday season for some, but also we're very much into an ongoing pandemic, which has been particularly awful for people inside of prisons. But instead, my dear Antisocial is here with a bit of prison abolitionist literature from many years ago, which may give us some food for thought and provide a bit of context to the discussions around prisoner solidarity and prisoner support.
Thanks a lot. I think I spoke on the show, I think it was maybe last year for the Week of Action, or could even be longer ago, solidarity with anarchist prisoners. Grateful that I had the chance, by the way. You know, I think I was presenting a summary of kind of situations of legal repression against anarchists, ongoing trials, anarchist prisoners who particularly needed money and support at the time. And it happens to me that sometimes people come up to me and ask me about writing to anarchist prisoners, prisoners in struggle, you know, who can I write to, what prisoner are they at, and so on. Everything short of kind of how do I lick an envelope. I had a bit of a crisis of conscience after one of these times. I started to wonder, what do people write in these letters? What is there to say? Kind of words of encouragement to someone who's desperate situation, you know, might be feeling very isolated and dejected. I mean, aren't you feeling isolated and dejected? What gets exchanged? We hear the slogan solidarity, not charity, a lot. But, you know, I guess in the light of, you know, my last appearance and I think your intentions to, you know, kind of remind people about, you know, the realities of prison, particularly for anarchist comrades, and the possibilities for breaking down those physical forms of isolation and so on. And just disseminating that and making it really clear and obvious how possible it is to do that. I thought it might be helpful just to interrupt the discourse a little bit with a little provocative text, which I came across by chance when I was perusing the archive in 56A InfoShop. It's in a zine, English and French zine called Terra Incognita. It's a text which has made me think a lot. And I think, you know, it's something that might... just spark a thought, inspire a discussion, just slow down the kind of treadmill of routine actions and responses and the circulation of information. And I don't really want to dissuade anyone from doing any of the good work that they're doing, but just throw a little spanner in the works, maybe. The piece is called To End with the Image of the Anti-Prison Struggle, and it's signed by Ex-Anarchist Black Cross Antwerp. And as I said, this thing is more than 10 years old. from a different geographical context as well. It's a well-known topic. Revolutionaries have always been confronted with it and will probably always be. It's about the tension between the analysing of the reality of the struggle and the methods of organisation and struggle that you make your own, and about the evidence that almost every method of organising that is not based on reciprocal knowledge, affinity and informality ends with producing a caricature and stimulating certain detrimental behaviours. Even more, it is impossible to separate the question of organisation from the content of a specific project or perspective. It's in this much schematized order that we want to clarify some of our choices and ideas. We don't intend to point the finger towards comrades or to deny certain dynamics natural development, meaning time, experiences, and mistakes. On the other hand, we're only deceiving ourselves if we wouldn't dare to criticize certain problematic realities within what one could call, with some goodwill, the anarchist movement. Maybe we differ in ideas with a number of comrades that struggle on the same terrain, prison in all its forms, and then it's good that these differences find their expression. On this theme, a series of texts and critiques have circulated that inspired us in the development of our project. We hope that the different comrades, each of them in his context and with her ideas, can use these experiences and considerations to sharpen their project. It's not a coincidence that the social ice age that we're living at the moment also has its consequences within the anarchist movement. Seeing the lack of clear perspectives and lost force to storm the heavens, it's almost logical that a part of the movement is reduced or reduces itself to a form of cheap folklore. One of the terrains where this misery flourishes abundantly is that of the struggle against prison. It seems to have become one of the chosen terrains to surround oneself with an aureole of radicalism and importance. Usually, certainly for those that aspire for a little more than easily consumable solidarity declarations, the emptiness and lack of perspective festers out quickly. It's very easy to give the image to the inside that you're, quote, active, because prisoners happen to have less means to grasp what is happening outside, to put it in its context, and to possibly oppose it. This image suffices to gain credit of other comrades, while in reality, contact with imprisoned comrades are not maintained, real will to fight against prison is lacking, or is almost extinct after so many negative experiences and so much pose instead of real struggle. Promises are made but not kept, and necessary continuity is lacking. Prisoners are most of the time a little longer in prison than for some months. While promising logos continue to flourish abundantly, some take their conclusions. The so-called struggle against prison sometimes resembles more a sort of anti-repression activism. Information has become the only goal, and the diffusers of information are the guardians of solidarity. And this information loses more and more of its meaning because it's made use of less and less. It's not being discussed, nor thought about how blows against comrades could be forged to an intensification of the struggle. The only thing that seems to matter is the diffusing of the information that stands on itself. And there, the logos also flourish abundantly. One repressive story follows the next. The blow against the movement is consumed as a spectacle with only spectators, and the imprisoned comrades are often detached of their struggle, context, and ideas. Solidarity cannot be reduced to the spreading of information. We understand solidarity as a permanent attempt or tension to, on the one hand, continue the struggle of the imprisoned comrades, and, on the other hand, to actively involve prisoners in discussions, in struggles outside, and so on. To use a slogan whose content has been so eroded in many, quote, anti-prison milieus, our solidarity is not charity. Indeed, our solidarity is based on a shared revolt, shared ideas, shared perspectives. That's, for us, the starting point, and one of the only ways to fight against the isolation that the state tries to impose on certain comrades. From this angle, the question of, quote, political and social prisoners could be undermined. It's not enough to proclaim that there wouldn't be a difference. The only criterion that we want to use for our solidarity is whether we share something of revolt or ideas with certain prisoners, detained for revolutionary or survival practices. In this sense, we made the choice not to twist and turn in order to express specific solidarity with imprisoned members of authoritarian groups or famous, quote, criminals whose criticizable aspects are persistently put aside. We think that the choice to base solidarity on shared revolt offers more than other choices the possibility of putting forward in a clear way the anarchist perspective of the destruction of prison and its world. Not only towards other prisoners, but also towards the oppressed and excluded in the street. While some circles' demagogy of political prisoners makes us puke even more, on the anarchist side it sometimes seemed to incline towards the contrary. Every prisoner that rebels is put on a pedestal and gets the etiquette of social rebel. This is a logical consequence of the detrimental mentality of not leaving from an own autonomous perspective, but attempting to obstinately discover, quote, subjects everywhere. We try to develop a struggle of our own, even with few, with a clear basis and practice. We no longer want to fool ourselves by putting etiquettes, no matter where. Moreover, this image that is given of certain prisoners impeaches any real discussion, so any development of a shared perspective. Prisoners are made into something that is put above us, and to the inside we send a completely falsified image of the outside movement's determination and strength. In this way, we're not only deceiving imprisoned comrades, but first of all, ourselves. The result is bitterness and aversion, inside and outside.
Thank you very much, Andy. We're going to have a jingle now, and then we're going to have a track.
It's 9 o'clock on Friday night,
and you're listening
to
Dissident Island
Radio.
Coming up
on tonight's episode:
magical la la fairy tale,
sandal wearing, muesli munching,
filthy, filthy liberals. How much do you want to bet they're vegan too?
Sounds like a lot of fun, doesn't it? If you want to be part of the summer of death. Thank you for listening to me. Take care. And I really do mean take care.
Animal! Animal! Animal!
Cool. So that was a song called Animal Alien by Nature Reserve. That song and all our songs this evening are going to be coming from the Hunts Abs Benefit Volume 2 compilation that has been released by On The Run Records. That's R-W-E-C-K-C-H-O-R-D-S. You can find that by searching for On The Run Records on Bandcamp. And yeah, you can buy individual tracks, you can buy a CD, you can buy the whole album digitally. All profits are donated to the Norwich, Mendip, Hunts Abs and Hounds Off. So yeah, pretty nice little stocking filler there. Now we're going to hear from Channel Rescue in light of the events in the English Channel that were 27 people died. Also in light of the fact that we didn't record their interview at the Anarchist Book Fair. It was an interesting time to pick up that thread with Simon. I actually had to cut it out, but just a little shout out to Hastings Support Refugees because they are doing really good stuff, especially in light of the kind of bizarre incident in Hastings this week where people actually tried to block a lifeboat going out to sea. So yeah, shout out to them, shout out to Channel Rescue. So I'm here with Simon, who is a volunteer with Channel Rescue. How's it going, Simon?
Hi there.
For people who maybe haven't heard of you, what is Channel Rescue and what sort of things do you get up to?
Channel Rescue is a grassroots volunteer-run organisation that aims to provide solidarity and human rights observation in the situation in the Channel where people are crossing the Channel to reach the UK.
And so is that basically keeping an eye on how the authorities are behaving towards people who are crossing the Channel, or is it actively engaging with people who are maybe landing on shores or are not too far out to sea?
Both, actually. We keep a watch out to sea from the cliffs. We've had boat patrols out and about in the Channel. We're watching how Border Force and the Coast Guard are interacting from a human rights perspective, but also if people make beach landings, people have been there to assist and see what those people need. Basic human solidarity with the people who are arriving in that way.
And so this is quite reminiscent of scenes that people might have seen from, you know, the shores of the Aegean or the Mediterranean in the last decade. Have people come with experience from those theatres and come and set up this group, or is it inspired by what's happened in those parts of the world to any extent?
Initially inspired by, but then we were rapidly joined by people who really brought a wealth of experience and expertise from the situation in the Mediterranean. We've been very lucky to very quickly make contact with fantastic organisations like Sea-Watch, Mare Liberum, so on and so forth. So that's absolutely the case. The lessons learned there are not immediately applicable in the Channel, but the fact these people have been grappling with something very similar for a long time was obviously hugely helpful.
So a lot of the broad strokes, I guess, to the story behind people crossing the Mediterranean or the Aegean are similar to the Channel. But the narrative that we're receiving here is that these boat crossings, I mean, there were more than 20,000 people have successfully crossed the Channel this year by small boats. So this is being portrayed as something that's very new, and there's something that we should be quite alarmed about in the UK, in the mainstream media. Is that the story behind these boat crossings? I mean, is this a new phenomenon?
People crossing the Channel to seek safety, to people coming from northern France, across the Channel, is not a new thing at all. It's been going on for a long time. It's been a major undercurrent situation in Calais. There's a huge number of people go over from the UK and do valuable solidarity work in Calais. You would have seen in the news, Sangatte, the jungle, the actions of the French riot police, all this kind of thing that's gone on in the Calais. And that's all because people are trying to get to the UK to get into to claim asylum in the UK. And they've had this obstacle course put up. So really, the main route into the UK for people until 2 or 3 years ago was getting into lorries and getting over and then getting into the UK and then claiming asylum. And what happened was the French government, at the behest of the British government, effectively fortified the motorway network all the way around Calais. And that meant that route was closed off. So really in 2019, we started to see the first people cross in boats. And that's now become an established route. Now, what you have to understand is it's actually still less people, and that number of asylum claims are down than there were. So the most number of people who crossed over Channel was huge in 2002. And that number's really diminished these days. 25,000 actually isn't that many people. But because obviously they've been forced to choose this new and much more visible route, and because the government, instead of acting the logical and compassionate way, have chosen to turn it into a front in the culture war, we're seeing these images splashed everywhere and crazy talk like this is a seaborne invasion. And it's just, you know, it's desperate people in boats. And really, in the broad scheme of things, not very many of them.
Yeah, I mean, I think this visibility is quite a crucial element in this story, because, I mean, you've got both the perception of this vulnerability that the state is trying to portray, that, you know, we are under some sort of an invasion, and also the theater of performative cruelty that, you know, the state has lashed out basically on people who do make it to the UK.
Yeah, I mean, the performative stuff with the barracks, the attempt, you know, these people must be punished to create an illusion of a seaborne invasion and turn people against these people. But it's deliberate. I mean, there's a very good article out there which is called, you know, Britain does not have a refugee crisis, so it had to invent one. And it talks about this and talks about how this could actually be dealt with in a humane and compassionate way quite easily. But it's actually a classic piece of scapegoating that's gone on. And actually, as we've seen last week, a lethal piece of scapegoating.
So yeah, we'll come to those points a little bit later, but I was wondering, could you take us through how the state response to these boat crossings has evolved since the 2019 point, or if you want to go a bit further back?
I mean, 2019 is fine, because that's really when there may well have been boat crossings before, but in 2019 we started to see people crossing, and initially actually very improvised. We would see people going into effectively the equivalent of Decathlon or Sports Direct in Calais and getting themselves a boat, the kind of boat you'd buy on holiday, and then getting themselves across the channel that way. That's obviously become a much bigger and more sophisticated operation on that side. And what we would see in 2019 and running into 2020 is a lot of beach landings. So people were actually making it all the way across the channel and then landing on the Kent coast. And that's actually really, to digress slightly, that's kind of where Channel Rescue came from, because there was a set of effectively far-right vigilantes who mobilised themselves to deter and meet beach landings. So that's kind of one of the places we came from. But obviously in 2020, this has whipped up and suddenly we started seeing far greater state resources deployed in the channel. We had the appointment of the ridiculously named Channel Clandestine Threat Commander, and four permanent border force vessels stationed in Dover, and drones, you know, air flight, increasing cooperation with the French state, and so on and so forth.
In terms of that state response from a policy perspective, we have the government pushing the Nationalities and Borders Bill through Parliament at the moment, which contains a lot of nasty stuff like the idea of offshoring asylum application processing. But one of the things that has been making a lot of noise about is this notion of doing migrant pushbacks in the channel. Can you talk to us a little bit about what that policy is and what it would look like if it was enacted?
So pushbacks appear to have been invented really by Priti Patel this summer. She made an announcement that Border Force would be pushing migrant boats back. And then 3 weeks later, after she made the announcement, I think it's around that sort of timescale, some of our volunteer cliff watchers actually watched Border Force practicing pushbacks. And that's the subject of our, which we may talk about in a bit, our legal case against Priti Patel at the moment. We're seeking a judicial review on this policy. You know, they loaded a dinghy up with Border Force people and then attempted to manoeuvre, as far as we can see, not very successfully. And that's with cooperative Border Force staff sat in the dinghy. So we're looking at this again. There's absolutely no way this policy can be enacted as it stands without loss of life. And obviously deliberately endangering people at sea is against international maritime law. It can't, how can it work? You know, what are they going to do? Push them into French territorial waters? You know, so what happens next? I mean, are the French going to stand by? They very clearly said they're not going to. They're going to stand by as British Border Force are operating in French territorial waters, doing something the French don't want them to do. I can't see how that's going to work. So to what extent it's show for the voters, again, we don't know. Whether they're going to try it or try, you know, some approach, we don't know. We're going to wait and see. I had thought that perhaps slightly optimistically that following the deaths last Wednesday, that we might see a reconsideration of this, that a more sensible avenue might be pursued here. At the very least, people would be able to claim asylum in northern France and then come across on the ferry. That hasn't been announced. What has been announced is a doubling down on this policy of pushbacks, which practically we can't see how it can work.
The other thing that they're trumpeting is this notion that they'll somehow send people to the Sandwich Islands or Falklands or Albania somehow. But that's obviously something we've seen in Australia. And I think a lot of the rhetoric and language around migration, whatever form it takes, has been robbed from Australia. I mean, this notion of the points-based immigration system, but also that offshoring, we've seen the results that yields.
Well, we've seen it in the Mediterranean. I mean, effectively, you know, migrants are offshored in the Mediterranean and they're kept on, you know, islands like Lesbos. That's effectively that process. And I think could see some sort of UK imitation of it. It would be enormously expensive to be flying migrants to and from the Falklands or, you know, the Ascension Islands or whatever. I can't see it happening in another sovereign state. I can't see how that would work. I'm sure they're working on it. Again, this is like it's very difficult to distinguish the propaganda from the practice. If there wasn't a need to wage the culture war to shore up their vote, then we could see quite a sensible migrant policy. Unfortunately, these people are being used as tools, pawns rather.
Yeah, so I mean, we've got all these state resources. I mean, there's a lot of money being spent. There's a lot of time and effort being spent on, you know, devising ever more nefarious ways of dealing with migrants. And you know, like you said, we've got all these extra boats and helicopters and all the rest of it going over the channel. Yet still, last week we had 27 people drown. There were reports today that they had made calls to both the British and French authorities asking for help and were basically ignored. So how do you see what happened last week? I mean, was it a tragic accident or is this the result of a deliberate policy?
We've been saying all along that what happened on Wednesday was an inevitability. That was going to happen. As we saw, what we've witnessed is talk about UK state intervention. So the UK has really, really pressured the French to stop launches from Calais. I mean, they can't stop launches all the way along the coast. It's simply unfeasible to do that without stationing an army there. So what people are actually doing is moving away from Calais, which is very heavily policed, and they're launching from further south. And that means instead of an 8-hour crossing in the kind of craft we're talking about, we're looking at 18 or 19 hour crossing, which is why we're starting to see so many more people landing in Dungeness and even as far west as Hastings. I mean, the other thing we're seeing are kind of what look like purpose-built boats. So they're not proper seagoing ribs. They're boats that would appear to have been built solely for one crossing. So they're rafts, really. They're much bigger and they carry 50 people, whereas the boats before were carrying 20 or 30. Even they were desperately overcrowded. So we're seeing people making longer sea journeys in unsuitable craft. And we've been saying this and saying this is going to happen. And obviously, particularly as this year, the season has carried on as people were trying it in clear weather in November. Of course, the sea is incredibly cold and the people go hypothermic almost immediately when they go into it. So we've been saying, you know, this is why we want safe routes. We are saying we have to have safe routes into the UK. So I think that is in terms of the actual specifics of the incident and whether or not British and French authorities deliberately ignored them. There's some serious questions to be answered there. And in fact, the threat commander, Dan Mahoney, I think his name is, he was in front of the Parliamentary Select Committee. And I would describe his responses as evasive, as the person in charge of the inquiry pushed him and said, okay, were these calls answered? Did you get a call from this specific boat? And he was replying with a very politician's-like answer of, we received this many calls and we responded to all of them. And she said, well, what does that response be? What do you mean by response? And he refused to be pinned down on what he meant by response. So it's entirely possible that calls were received and not taken seriously, or calls were received and said, well, you're in French territorial waters, so it's not our problem. The UK did scramble resources towards the incident, but it's possible that happened hours after it was initially reported. But without knowing the full facts, and Channel Rescue in the process and other groups putting in freedom of information requests, of course, there'll be an inquest on the French side, and we will know more facts about that.
So a lot of people responded in a very humane way to the deaths of those 27 people. And we saw a lot of demonstrations in various cities across the UK calling for a more humane approach to migration and solidarity with migrants. But do you think this is actually going to change anything? And do you think that the response of the state in the past week has indicated that any sort of softening of the approach or even just a more sensible approach?
No, I mean, I really think they had a breathing space there. And in fact, because they've been making a lot of noise about what the French ought to be doing. I mean, the French spokesman for the French government effectively said, why don't you accept asylum claims on French soil? I was really surprised that they offered that. I'm guessing from the French point of view, that would be doing that and then getting on the ferry straight to the UK to be processed. I thought, okay, maybe there's a glimmer of light here. Maybe that might change. We certainly noticed in the 3 days of us doing media interviews around this, a change in the narrative, because it's clearly the common sense solution. And I thought maybe there was a glimmer of it, but no, they've doubled down and said they're going to carry on with pushbacks. So no, there's been no softening the state's stance. I think what's fascinating about it, there is a huge reservoir of people out there who know this is the wrong thing to do. And I think it's not a minority of people. I think that's why it's very important to be visibly against what's going on in the channel, with the militarization, securitization of the channel. I think that's why we need human rights observers there. We haven't slid yet as a country so badly that we are going to accept thousands of deaths in the channel or hundreds of deaths in the channel. This is difficult because obviously the 27 deaths came on top of 8 or 9 deaths. And that's not been confirmed whether it was 8 or 9 deaths. Yes, I mean, we really don't want to get to a situation where it's the death toll in the channel is just an add-on to the news. I mean, that's why we exist. That's why we were created. We think, okay, we can't just let this go uncontested.
So in terms of how you are responding then, what is most of your energy going into now? I mean, has your response changed at all because of last week's events, or has your focus changed?
We put out a fundraiser for our judicial review to make up the £5,000 worth of legal fees that we advised we were going to need. And I think it was a bizarre, macabre coincidence. It was, but it happened an hour and a half before the news of this tragedy came through, and suddenly, bang, we've got £30,000. People are writing in to volunteer. People want to know what they can do. You know, I don't want to say too much about what we're going to do. We're obviously going to be, you know, maintaining our shore patrols, keeping the human rights monitoring up, keeping the pressure up, seeing what legal routes we can take to contest what's going on. That's the future for it, I think, because I don't think this struggle is going anywhere.
And that legal challenge is a judicial review of the proposed policy to have these pushbacks that you were describing earlier with the jet skis and the dinghies.
Yep. We're contesting it under maritime law, saying it's not compatible with international maritime law. And they have contested that, and they've made disclosure. We can't talk about the disclosure because that's against the rules. So watch this space, effectively, I think. And, of course, there is the parallel court case where the Border Forces Union, the union that many Border Force people belong to, the PCS, are also seeking a judicial review of the policy on human rights grounds.
Yeah, so you've ended up with some strange bedfellows here because the PCS, the trade union that many Border Force staff are members of, as you said. Is it a coincidence that you're ending up in the same courtroom? And to what extent have you been engaging, or do you think you can engage with Border Force staff to essentially stop this policy from being pursued?
So I think we don't even know if we're going to be in the same courtroom. You know, we're glad they're bringing this action. Perhaps if that, you know, led to some reflection on some of their parts as to what the large part of their process of what they're actually engaged in means, what it inevitably means, that would be welcome. We haven't had any formal conversations with the PCS about this. We may end up, who knows, where a case management conference might take us. We are actually attacking this decision of Priti Patel's on two quite different angles. So we'll have to see where that ends up. I think the fact that the Border Force's own union are coming out against this policy, I think that's almost unprecedented. But I think our agendas are quite different.
Do you think there is enough crossover in your areas of concern to form, even albeit a loose coalition, but do you think there is the potential for any sort of a coalition there?
I don't know about coalition. I think it is strong that they're coming forward and saying this pushbacks policy cannot be enacted because effectively it would require contracted employees to break the law, which is something you're not allowed to do. And I think, no, I'm no lawyer, I think that's the basis of what they're saying. So I fully support it. I doubt Channel Rescue will be going into coalition with Border Force.
Fair enough. Okay, so you're keeping them at arm's length. But I guess there are groups there that you might be a bit more comfortable getting into bed with, so to speak. There's Care for Calais, who do a lot of action on the north coast of France, where a lot of these journeys start. And then there's the Kent Refugee Action Network, who I spoke to last year. And they try and help young asylum seekers find support and housing and so on. So is Channel Rescue actively engaging with these groups? And have you found a way to support and bolster each other?
I mean, one thing I'll say, and this is just as a volunteer, so I'm not speaking for Channel Rescue, Migrant Solidarity, it's just huge numbers of different little groups all working to the same agenda, hundreds of really committed, brilliant people. It could probably do with more coherence. I wouldn't want it to lose the magic of what it's got by trying to bring it into some kind of central organisation or whatever. But yeah, there's obviously this huge overlapping concern. Volunteers, you know, people in Channel Rescue have volunteered at Napier Barracks, people from Channel Rescue are in Calais, work with Care for Calais or Refugee Community Kitchen, and so on and so forth. You know, of course, there's a massive crossover here, and people wear a lot of different hats. We've chosen to focus on this very specific angle of human rights monitoring in the channel as an organisation, But of course, people are concerned with the whole migrant solidarity, right down to providing food distribution for people who are in hotels in their hometowns, which are, you know, hundreds of miles away from the coast, but who also volunteer with Channel Rescue. I think that's one of the things interesting about migrant solidarity. There's a big, big network, but it's not very visible. And it ought to be, because I think you can often come away in this country feeling like the vast majority of people are anti-migrant, bigoted, and so on. So you can really feel that. And I certainly felt that when I was doing a lot of radio interviews over the last week. You would get the people who would bother phoning in would be anti-migrant. But actually, when you look at how people self-organise, often absolutely brilliantly self-organise, to, you know, Hastings is a great example. There's Friends of Napier Barracks, who are just some people to organise themselves to provide basic solidarity with the people in the barracks in terms of, you know, bringing them bags, bringing them clothes, all this kind of stuff. People organise. I always like to give Reading Red Kitchen a shout out for this brilliant work they did supporting the migrants who were billeted there. So, yeah, there's this massive network of people. I just think it should be more visible.
So if people have been listening and they think that Channel Rescue is the right way for them to put pressure, what are the ways that you're looking for people to engage with you and to support Channel Rescue as a group?
I mean, multiple different ways, really. I mean, please, you know, go and have a look at our website, channelrescue.org. Look for us on Twitter. Look for us on Facebook. Very easy to find. Obviously, we always need shore volunteers. We need funds. There's all sorts of expertise we need. We need people to help with admin. So, yeah, there's multiple different ways in which you could be useful and put their pressure that way.
Well, I'm sure you would encourage people to look in their local area as well, because, yeah, like you said, there's a plethora of groups out there in pretty much every, you know, town or city. Or
Somebody, and it's not going to be me, somebody should do a proper directory of where to find and help people, because it actually can be quite difficult sometimes to sort of think, okay, you know, what do I do if I want to help migrants and I live in Wolverhampton? Then, you know, where do you find that? And there will be people doing this work. Whether it'll be easy to find them and get involved is another question entirely. Maybe it's a project for someone else at another time.
There's a shout out for somebody who loves admin. Okay, awesome. Right, well, hats off to you, Simon, for what you're up to down there in Kent. And yeah, thanks a lot for giving us your time.
Thanks very much for letting me on.
Rick Mason's head is washed up on the beach. Sun goes down and we're gonna have a party. Fireworks and screaming light up evening sky. Throw your Jan and Dean records on the barbie. Keep off the sand, this is not your land. Keep out of the sea, keep the water clean. Don't ride the waves, cause you'll meet an Ellie Gray. Put a stop to your tricks when you get ripped a bit. Beach life isn't cheap. It will cost you an arm and a leg. Not only in the trendy shops, but in the open water. Tear down the blue flag. Hoist up the black flag. Lead the surfers out to the slaughter. Keep off the sand. This is not your land. Keep out of the sea. Keep the water clean. Waves, cause you'll meet an early grave. I put a stop to your tricks when you get ripped a bit. Rick Mason's head is washed up on the beach. Sun goes down and we're gonna have a party. Fireworks and screaming light up evening sky. Throw your Jan and Dean records on the barbie. Keep off the sand, this is not your land. Out of the sea, keep the water clean. Don't ride the waves, cause you'll meet an Ellie Gray. I put a stop to your tricks when you get ripped to bits. Beach life isn't cheap, it will cost you an arm and a leg. Not only in the trendy shops, but in the open water. Tear down the blue flag, hoist up the black flag. Lead the surfers out to the slaughter. Sound, this is not your land. Keep out of the sea, keep the water clean. Don't ride the waves, cause you'll meet an Ellie Gray. I put a stop to your tricks when you get ripped to bits.
sharks against, sharks against, sharks against, surfers, sharks against, sharks against, sharks against, surfers, sharks against, sharks against, sharks against, surfers, sharks against, sharks against, sharks against, surfers.
Cool, so that was Chris Butler with Sharks Against Surfers. That's off the Hunt Sabs Benefit Volume 2 on the Run Records. Andrew?
Well, thank you. And here we are again from the Activist Court Aid Battalion. No, we decided on Brigade because maybe numbers should be considered to be up. I think we've actually got about 10, so... if anyone's interested in doing court and other types of legal support, do get in touch. So, what can we talk about in the run-up to the happy seasonal festivities? Well, the Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill is dragging its way to conclusion. We get the Lords review stage on the 6th of December, and then it looks like we get a final run-through on the 8th, which will be Wednesday next week, and there will be a demo against it, and it will be passed. I should say, like a lot of modern bills, only a very small part of it comes immediately into effect. So there might be some last-minute changes, and most of the provisions have a two-month delay after. The one thing that comes in immediately, I should point out, is the doubling the maximum sentence for assault on an emergency worker from 1 year to 2 years. So not that I would ever advocate that people went out and acted on that in the few days that you have left, because that would be very wrong. Now, it is a feature of every time a substantial new bill comes in that we are against it, and we try to generate as much publicity about all the bad provisions that are in it, and you will have seen quite a lot of those. I'm not going to try to go through all aspects of the bill, and as we do not have anywhere near the time that to cover the roughly 300 sections and 20 schedules attached to it. Plus, there will be some codes of practice on some of the more important stuff, particularly the regulation of processions and assemblies that have not yet even been written. So, but what I will try to convey is that we want to try to get people to take a middle line between, oh, ain't it awful, and not to exaggerate, it's not the end of the world, it's not the worst ever bill that we've come in. And as you imagine, we will be going through it. In fact, we've got people going through it now, provisionally, line by line, to see what those changes are. And when we have to alter any particular legal advice to people, most of which will be around concessions on demos, but there are some other things I'll point towards. We will put that out before they come into force through both ACAB and NetPol, that we are part of, Network for Police Monitoring, and other good organisations. If you are seeing lots of panicky stuff that sounds like, are you sure that this is actually in the bill or not, you may use what we call the 51-week test. So if you read an article about the bill that says there will be penalties of 51 weeks imprisonment for anything that they happen to mention, there are quite a few crimes that are in the bill that either are, or if introduced, or being increased to 51 weeks, then that person does not explain that the 51 weeks is not yet in force, and in fact it means 6 months, then they don't know what they're talking about. A classic example is the headline article with George Monbiot in The Guardian. So Monbiot may occasionally have his heart in the right place, but it is surprising that even if he is clueless about the nature of the 51-week saga, which I'm going to tell you about in a second, that no one at The Guardian knows a lawyer who could have told him better. And one of the reasons it's surprising is that this was a product of a previous panic bill, the Criminal Justice Act of 2003, which again had a vast number of provisions, one of which invented something called Custody Plus. In fact, it had a whole raft of sections inventing it. And New Labour, bless them, remember them? They were going to do two really good, one good thing, one bad thing. The good thing is that they were going to abolish all prison sentences of less than 28 weeks, as they had been told, as every government has been for probably the last 100 years, that short prison sentences do not work, are not helpful, and just encourage crime by sending people to the universities of them for short periods. So that was a really sensible provision. The really bad thing is that they were then going to invent something called Custody Plus that meant that you did some time in prison and then had to do community service afterwards for periods between 28 and 51 weeks. And once they introduced that, they would increase the powers of magistrates to pass sentences of Custody Plus up to 51 weeks. Never happened. And, of course, the reason it didn't happen is that they were unwilling to invest any money in actual rehabilitation, helping people in the community when they got out of prison, which was in part of the plus section of Custody Plus. But what they did do is that they altered all previous acts to Parliament which said that the maximum penalty was 6 months to 51 weeks in one little provision. And every new offence that has come in since 2003, the legislation says 51 weeks. So if you look it up, and you look up any act, it will say 51 weeks. What it will not say is 6 months until the provisions of Section 281 of the Criminal Justice Act 2003 come into force. And they haven't, and they're not going to now. If there is going to be some change, then it will be some different change, because it's now very difficult to introduce that, because all the provisions relating to Custody Pass and the probation resources devoted to him have all been rescinded in various other legislation. So they will be faced with the alternative of bringing in a straight change of just increasing magistrates' sentencing powers, which is possible, but that will require a big consultative change, because it significantly alters magistrates' powers in a way that the actual 51-week thing didn't, because under Custody Plus, you were only serving up to the 28 weeks in custody and then were supposedly going to do some productive community service afterwards. So have a look out for that little shibboleth, as they say in the trade. So how much of the time have I used up already on this windbag of an act? There are some things in it that are really important. And I'd like to emphasise that Section 167 of the Act clears up a major problem in jury trials that we have waited since 1974 Juries Act to have this fixed. In trials in the Crown Court, there is usually a panel of 12 jurors. If some become sick, the trial can continue while you've still got 9 jurors left, and it alters the rules on majority verdicts. But in the case of trials involving the death penalty, the written consent of the prosecution and the defence is required if the trial is to continue, if even one juror is invalided out, either by death, illness, or some other emergency. And Section 167 of the Police Crime Sentencing Courts Act repeals Section 12 of the Juries Act 1974. Fixing this problem, which you might worry about because no one has actually got the death sentence since 1965, and the remaining offences, which included treason and piracy with violence, and certain offences relating to mutiny in the armed forces, including the very desperate act of giving false air signals, finally abolished in 1998. So some stupid Jodsworth has added this to the bill just to make their name for fixing this error that has been totally without any use for at least 23 years, and in fact for over 60. There you go. So that's what they're wasting your money on, because every version of the bill gets reprinted at the chopping down of the trees each time, so that the nearsighted lords can look at it again and again while sipping away on the brandies at the subsidised bar. So that will conclude how far we're going today on the miserable bill, but there will be a briefing in full and various updates on all the actual relevant sections when they come to pass. Now, other updates from the happy or unhappy side of the legal world, and we regularly update you with what's happening with the Bristol Kill the Bill protesters. There are another 9 people having their first appearance at the Crown Court on the 10th of December, so we wish them luck, and particularly to Ryan Roberts, who will be sentenced at a date not yet decided, but probably just in the week before Christmas, so especially best luck to them. There are currently 9 people in prison from the Kill the Bill demo in April, and 1 more from the demo on the 1st of May. And you can write to them. Thanks for highlighting the issues involved in writing to prisoners. So think carefully about it and do not do it in a light-hearted fashion, because many of them will be in for some time. The details of those who want to be written to can be found on the Bristol Anarchist Black Cross website. There are other ongoing and serious cases, also some relating to Kill the Bill. In London, there's a violent disorder cases, and there are some in Newcastle as well. There is also cases ongoing from Black Lives Matter. We have someone up for violent disorder at Southwark on the 15th of December, which we are supporting as best we can. And we also have people from Palestine Action, one of whom was in court today in North Staffordshire Magistrates. So I don't have great hopes for that one. But there will be much more serious Palestine Action cases coming up for those who have, shall we say, achieved a greater impact on the Elbit factories than just standing outside and complaining about them. On the subject of people in jail, there are also now more people in this country in jail for political stuff than there has been for a very long time. I think we would have to go back to about 2011 with people jailed for the student protests, the March 25th trade union march. Aside from the people mentioned in Bristol, there is, of course, Insulate Britain. Their imprisonment is slightly different. It is a civil imprisonment for contempt of court, for flouting the court's orders.
Welcome back to CKUT. My name is Sarah Jesmer. You were just listening to an episode of Dissident Island Radio. It's an excerpt of their December 5th, 2021 show. If you want to hear the rest of this episode or more by these creators, you can find them at dissidentisland.org. Again, dissidentisland.org.
What? My radio stuck on CKUT. I don't know. But nah, fix it. CKUT, the number one radio station in Montreal. We give you the sun, the moon, the rain, the stars and the mountain. CKUT give you the word.
I'm Brian Jefferson. And before you go, here's some news that you can use.
Are you a tenant in Montreal? Do you have questions about your rights? Your local housing committee can help. To find the housing committee for your neighborhood or for more resources, go to www.rclalq.qc.ca.
I'm Martin Carly, and I like to popularize science. Vaccination against COVID-19 for children aged 5 to 11 has begun. As parents, you may be asking if your child will receive the same vaccine as adults. The vaccine used for children younger than 12 years old contains a smaller amount of mRNA because children's immune systems respond better than those of adults. And even though they're given smaller doses, the vaccine is just as effective.
For more information, visit quebec.ca/youthvaccine. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
And CKUT is entering a holiday period, so some of our programming will change as the month ends. Thanks for tuning in every week. and you can always find the old shows in our archives at ckut.ca.
Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this.
And that concludes this Friday's edition of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective. The collective includes Brian Jefferson, Alice Wu, Kate Addison, Joel Salmadal, and Sarah Jesmer. For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 7000, or news intern at ckut.ca. Also, you can follow us on Instagram at OffTheHourMTL, or connect with us on Facebook, search for us on CKUT. Stay tuned for Cafe coming up next on 90.3 FM.
Bonsoir tout le monde, c'est Alex qui vous parle. Vous êtes sur les ondes de CKUT. Il est 18h et vous écoutez votre émission d'art et culture préférée du vendredi soir, l'émission Café. Je vous parle depuis mon studio maison un peu plus tôt dans la semaine, mais lorsque vous allez m'entendre, nous serons vendredi le 10 décembre. Et je sais pas pour vous, mais pour moi, le temps a tellement passé vite, j'en reviens pas qu'on soit déjà rendu à la mi-décembre. Et d'ailleurs, parlant de temps qui passe trop vite parce qu'on fait les liens qu'on peut, il reste une seule journée pour participer à la campagne hashtag soutenez vos scènes lancée par l'Association des scènes de musique alternative du Québec, mieux connue sous le pseudonyme SMAC. L'association a donc déployé une grosse campagne de sociofinancement un peu plus tôt dans l'année dans le but de participer à la relance économique du milieu des arts de la scène alternative qui a été vraiment durement touchée par la pandémie et qui a encore beaucoup de difficultés à se relever de celle-ci. Elle n'est pas encore terminée et elles le sentent encore. Donc, pour contribuer, c'est vraiment super simple. Vous n'avez qu'à visiter le site internet laruchequebec.com. Et vous pouvez y acheter des billets pour vos salles de concerts alternatives préférées. Le but, c'est vraiment d'injecter des liquidités à ces salles de spectacle partout au Québec. À Montréal, par exemple, il y a dans nos salles de spectacle préférées,